Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
I'm going to make matters worse by also having 3 points. Thankfully, though, the 3 points of my TED Talk are pointing at something slightly different from Father's topic. I'll be pointing at some of the psychological activities that comprise the complex activity that we call studying. Regarding these activities, I will address 3 hows, 2 of which are going to be theoretical, and the last of which is going to be practical, or so I hope. I will look first at how studying differs from imposter activities that we might mistake for studying, especially when we're trying to study. Second, I'll note how consecrated study, which I will be addressing, differs from sacred study, which Father was addressing. And third, I'll suggest how we might go about consecrating our acts of studying. So, part one, how does studying differ from its imposters? I hope you will indulge me with a brief vignette. Suppose you arrived in DC yesterday afternoon with just enough time to explore a bit before the beginning of the conference. Suppose, too, that although you have in your pocket a TI-provided map of the Catholic wonderland that is Northeast DC, you decide to go rustic and just walk around. You even decide to leave your phone behind. As you walk, you engage in the activity that I'm calling spectating. You perceive things and how they are related to other things. As you focus your attention on things, your imagination spontaneously forms an internal representation of them. A.G. Sertelange, O.P., calls this internal representation an effigy of the real. In spectating, our attention is on the real, and not on the internal effigy of the real. Suppose now that since you are directionally challenged, you know you are, you take a few moments to place in your memory various landmarks, like the fig trees by the School of Philosophy or the spaceship by the architecture school. You haven't seen it? It's there. Here, you're engaging in memorization. Unlike spectating, the activity of memorizing involves deliberately focusing on the effigy, that is, on the internal representation, usually in order that we can later recall that effigy. Suppose further that while you're standing in front of the spaceship, you begin to wonder where else on campus it might have been placed or landed. You consult your internal effigy and engage in a bit of puzzling. You focus on the effigy and rearrange its parts in order to see possibilities. Suppose finally that as you're imaginatively placing the spaceship on the lawn of the Dominican House of Studies, you hear the shrine bells ringing for Mass. Since you've only memorized a few landmarks, and since you don't like to be late, you break down and break out your map. To your horror, the map contains none of the landmarks that you've memorized or that you see in front of you. It's at this point that you begin to study. You focus on your internal effigy in order to discover precisely how it relates to the real. You're looking for what in the effigy isn't actionable, for what's impossible, incomplete, or incorrect. You're doing this, of course, in order to work out those problematic areas of the effigy so that they fully represent the real. Studying, unlike spectating, memorizing, and puzzling, is uniquely concerned with working out the way things are. Spectating doesn't involve much work. Memorizing involves work, but not the work of working out how things are. And puzzling isn't about how things are, but how they might be. This is what I take St. Thomas to mean when he defines study as the vehement application of the mind to something. I'd like to say two things about study as the activity of working out the way things are. First, the work of studying involves the coordination of three more elemental works. The first work of studying is the work of noticing that there's a problem with one's effigy. This involves not only paying attention to how we represent and understand the subject matter, but also to how we respond to these things. It's often the case that we register problems first on the level of affect, even before we're intellectually conscious that anything's wrong. Zoning out, being frustrated, and being confused are all signs that there's a problem, even if not in the subject matter, then at least in our understanding of it. The second work of studying is the work of articulating what the problem is. It's one thing to notice that there's a problem, and it's another thing to notice what the problem is. Ordinarily, we recognize what something is when we see its parts. We tend to see the parts of things best when we put words to those parts that we do see. Putting words to the problem doesn't remove it, but it does reduce it. When we name something, we put a boundary between it and everything else. Even if we've drawn the boundary incorrectly, the fact that there is a boundary allows us to focus here rather than everywhere, or here in a smaller place rather than here in this general area. The third work of studying, the work of responding to the problem, begins as soon as we've articulated the problem well enough to see precisely where the conflict lies. Once we've articulated enough, there are only three ways that we can respond. We can choose to fight the problem, that is, to continue to study, to look for some resolution. We can choose to flee the problem, that is, to stop looking, either at the conflict or for a resolution. Or we can choose neither to flee nor to fight, but to stand still, to continue to look at the conflict, but not look for a resolution. We can choose rather just to wait with the conflict. My second comment about the work of study is that this work isn't for its own sake, but for the sake of resting in what it is that gets worked out. Rest in this sense, and not in the sense of taking a break to play foosball or paint your nails, involves both the rest of the mind from the activity of attending to many things and how they're related, and also the rest of the will from the activity of desiring but not yet possessing. Bringing all these observations together, studying is the work of attending to our representations of things with a view to noticing problems, articulating them, and responding to them, and eventually resting in what we've come to see. Part two. How can these works of studying be consecrated to God? And how does consecrated studying differ from the sacred studying that Father Stephen addressed? I'll answer the second question first, both because it's easier and because it makes a nice intro to the harder question. Sacred study is study that's chiefly directed to the contemplation of divine things. Its subject matter is expressly related to God. Although it's never recommended, in theory, one would still be engaging in sacred study even if one didn't do so on one's knees, relying rather on one's own native intelligence. Don't do that. Consecrated study, on the other hand, needn't have God or divine things as its subject matter. We consecrate our study, thus making it spiritually fruitful, each time we not only dedicate our study to God and ask for his blessing, but surrender to his action in each of the three works of studying. Although dedication and petition are important, I'm going to focus exclusively on surrender. Since the Christian life is infinitely more about God doing things in us than about our doing things for God. To paraphrase St. Paul, if I've studied all things but haven't surrendered, I'm a noisy, self-reliant gong. And here we've stumbled on to the harder question. How do we surrender our works of studying to the action of God? What I mean by surrender is the explicit and ongoing invitation to God to do in and through us whatever he desires, Here's what surrender might look like in each of the three works of studying. In noticing, invite the Holy Spirit to direct your attention wherever he desires. Trust that he receives your invitation, even if you don't immediately notice anything. In articulating, open your imagination to the Holy Spirit. Invite him to be present in your imagination, even in the parts that you can't see. And in responding, don't make a rule for yourself for how you will respond to what you see. Even what the Holy Spirit has inclined you to in the past shouldn't be made into a rule. Make your only rule to say, "Into your hands, Lord, I commend my spirit." Part 3. And how do we go about surrendering? There are some questions that are too simple to be answered without trying to explain away mystery. This is probably one of those questions. Rather than just leaving you with the mystery, though, I'll try to answer a similar question which might shed light on the simpler one. Namely, what can we do that will prepare us to surrender to the Holy Spirit as we study? The answer, which St. Thomas most definitely embodied, is to pursue both discipline and delight, taking up each of these in turn. By discipline, I don't mean simply observing a scheduled study time and keeping your desk neat. I mean discipline on the level of the psychological activities that I mentioned earlier, chiefly imagining and intending. If we have a disciplined imagination and a disciplined capacity to direct our attention, we will be more capable of handing these over to the Holy Spirit. I'll offer here some specific disciplines that you might take for a test drive. Regarding the imagination, first, when you come across something that seems significant, place it in your imagination. Don't simply internalize other people's words about the thing, but mark the thing's parts in your imagination. Second, say no to activities that train you to be passive in the face of images. Often, out of exhaustion, we'll settle down just to be entertained in a way that requires us neither to think nor to imagine, but only to be passive in the face of an external barrage of images and ideas. As often as your duty permits, say no to activities that scatter and weaken your attention in this way. And as often as you must engage in these activities, try to do so in a way that you actively resist becoming passive. Regarding the capacity to attend and intend, first, whatever your natural motives are for studying, formulate the intention, or at least the wish, to study primarily in order for the Holy Spirit to move within you. We can have multiple intentions, but one is always primary. Be aware that the natural motives for studying, namely curiosity, necessity, fear of inadequacy, love of challenge, all of these will vie for primacy. And if you feel burdened with one of these motives, take consolation in knowing that your study can still be incredibly fruitful spiritually if you open it up to the Holy Spirit. Second, when it comes to whether you should study at all or whether you should continue studying when the going gets tough, don't hand the decision over to your feelings. Fighting when you want to, fleeing when you don't want to fight, and standing still when you're not sure what you want. Discernment involves knowing what you want, but it's far more than this. Third, don't assume that you should study or that you should study every problem that you recognize. Every should comes from somewhere. This should seems to me to come from a spirit of workaholism, which can manifest itself as much in mental work as in external busyness. And fourthly, don't study or turn away from studying if doing so would compromise your ability to attend to what your state in life obliges you to attend to. Being curious about and capable of thinking things through isn't a sufficient reason to do so. St. Thomas calls the tendency to study anything that suits our fancy curiositas, and he classifies it as a vice that opposes the virtue of studying well, studiositas. Just in case this is sounding dour, I'll close with a second way to facilitate surrender, namely attending to what brings us delight. Ordinarily, when the Holy Spirit moves us, he does so by drawing us, by making something delightful to us, or by directing our attention to something we already know to be delightful. He's obviously capable of driving us, say, into the desert for 40 days, but he seems to prefer to lead by delight. Although the delight that arises in us, thanks to the Holy Spirit, is different from the natural delight that we take in things, we can facilitate our sensitivity to supernatural delight by becoming sensitive to natural delight. Noticing the presence or the absence of delight in studying seems to me to be particularly important for those of us who are prone to being Kantian. You know who you are. We can find ourselves studying not because we delight in it, but because we're good at it, and we think we're obliged to do what we're good at. Noticing delight is also important for those of us who might turn to studying as a distraction from other less delightful things. Toward distractions, we don't feel delight so much as relief or comparative attraction. When the Holy Spirit prompts us by delight, he does so in a manner that is free, not only from coercion, but also from comparison or calculation. And that is the conclusion.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.